General Gasparna of Operation Warp Speed said that they hadn't factored in some steps between making a vaccine and clearing it for release, and that had thrown the estimates off. Those shifting numbers actually made it really hard for states to plan. You know, they're telling hospitals and nursing homes to get ready, to sign people up to get their shots on a certain day. And then they've had to say, hold up, never mind, let's maybe try for next week. So Operation Warp Speed says they hear that it's been hard. They're getting things into a regular flow where states can order vaccines every week, and that should make it smoother going forward.
Let me ask you about a really vulnerable community, nursing home residents. It sounds like they are starting to get vaccinated. How is that effort going?
Yeah, absolutely. So pharmacy teams have started going out in about a dozen states, including Ohio and Connecticut and Florida, and at least a dozen and maybe more states will be joining next week. So most states have opted into this federal program where teams from national pharmacy chains like CVS and Walgreens will be visiting nursing homes and other long-term care facilities to give COVID vaccines to both their residents and their staff. And they're sending teams of pharmacists and technicians to facilities at least three times to try and cover everyone with those two doses required for the vaccine. And as you mentioned, long-term care facilities have been hit really hard by the pandemic. They account for 40% of deaths. So health officials are saying that we could start seeing a decrease in overall COVID mortality within weeks of this program being launched.
All right. That is the update on these much awaited vaccines starting to get out there into the country as we get an update on this Christmas Day. NPR's Ping Huang, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When Christina Haswood was elected to the Kansas State Legislature, she became the youngest person to ever sit in that chamber. How did she court young voters? Well, Haswood got on TikTok to meet the young folks where they're at. A lot of politicians are doing it. Here's Aviva Okeson-Haberman of member station KCUR.
TikTok occupies a weird corner of the internet, sparking short-lived trends like dancing to a voicemail from a toxic ex or creating a musical based on Ratatouille. So you might not think it's a natural fit for politicians, like Christina Haswood. She created a campaign account in her bid to join the Kansas State House.
I was about 25 when I got on TikTok, and I was like, I don't think I'm young enough for TikTok.
Her account didn't really take off until a high school student, Connor Thrash, asked if he could help.
She had the capabilities. She just needed like a teenager to like get her onto the trendy side of TikTok.
I was like, please. Obviously, what are we doing is not working.
As the TikTok manager, Thrash kept tabs on popular trends.
I'll be like, okay, think, Connor, how can you make this political and how can you keep it like PG?
Enter a deep house remix of Taylor Swift's Love Song. The trend, way back in July, was to have the camera pan out mid-song to capture some suggestive dance moves. Haswood instead power walks to the beat as text appears listing her priorities, like expanding Medicaid. It worked. A video about policy priorities in a tiny Kansas district got about 250,000 likes. Once she takes office, she plans to give her followers a behind-the-scenes look at the legislative process.
I really want to bring this level of transparency, but a level of realness that a lot of us younger people, people of color, young women of color, indigenous peoples, belong in these positions.
Juan Carlos Medina is a data scientist who researches TikTok at the University of Munich. He says it can be a powerful way to connect with a younger audience.
TikTok is playing a big part for the new generations of creating these new political opinions and identity. And you have also a lot of very young users, right? So they don't know politics differently.
Some politicians are taking note of the app's rising popularity. In Arizona, Gabriela Cáceres Kelly's campaign manager made her create an account when she ran for office. Cáceres Kelly is a member of the Dana'atam Nation. In her third TikTok posting, she's riding an electric scooter and zooming through the screen while shouting,
"Excuse me, I'm indigenous, coming through."
That image became a symbol of her campaign, printed on buttons, posters, and stickers. And it brought attention to her bid for county recorder, an important position, but admittedly one that's a bit obscure.
This very visible campaign largely had to do with this idea that I'm an Indigenous woman coming through, with or without your permission.
That attitude inspired Christina Haswood in Kansas. She'll be one of only three Native American women serving in the state house. And she admits she didn't cast her first vote until 2016 because she felt like her voice didn't matter.
My entire life has been balancing on this fine line of Western society and being an Indigenous woman. And I really wanted to highlight this on TikTok.
For Haswood and others, using TikTok offers them a chance not just to try to demystify state policy, but also to reach out to people who might have been reluctant to engage in the political process. For NPR News, I'm Aviva Okeson-Haberman in Kansas City.
And now for Christmas in Bethlehem. The ancient community has seen so much over the years, spiked with war and conflict, but none quite like this year's holiday during a pandemic. NPR's Daniel Estrin went to the Palestinian town and has this report.
The Church of the Nativity is shockingly empty. No pilgrims lining up to kiss the spot where tradition says Jesus was born. Local tour guide Nidal Korna idles at the entrance.
First Lebanese War, Second Lebanese War, Gaza War, Gulf War. Whatever happened around Middle East, we were always affected. Never been this situation. Today we are in the zero level.
Last Christmas capped a record year for Bethlehem tourism. No room at the inns. Hotels were fully booked. Then the pandemic reached the Holy Land. Until today, Israel bans foreign tourists. The Bethlehem Chamber of Commerce says about one in five of the city's businesses will never recover. Olive wood carver Jack Giacomon stands outside his shop.
The shop closed. As you can see, it is dusty. The street is empty.
Bethlehem is hemmed in by a concrete wall Israel built during a wave of Palestinian attacks. Palestinians say it makes their lives a ghetto and impedes their access to nearby Jerusalem. Giacomon says the pandemic highlights the inequalities between the two sides.
In Israel, they have a very strong government with a lot of money. They give the people during lockdown money, medical care. They have very strong medical care. Here, people don't find medical care. They don't get money from the government. There is a big gap between the two people, just one wall separating between.
But then a sudden swell of emotion in downtown Bethlehem. The marching bands arrive. Palestinian boy and girl scouts in crisp, colorful uniforms, tossing batons in the air, playing bagpipes, drums, and trombones through the quiet streets. Girl scout Celine Bitar.
Usually these streets are full of people, but we have to go and to show people our love to them and to this special day on Bethlehem. So this is our joy to come to here today.
They herald the arrival of the top Roman Catholic Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pier Battista Pizzaballa, draped in pink. He just recovered from COVID-19 a few days before. He presides over midnight mass of just a few dozen worshipers. The choir keeps their masks on. His homily is broadcast live.
Everyone feels darkened, tired, exhausted, even oppressed. Under the heavy burden of this pandemic.
He says the message of Christmas and the pandemic is that love is the only path to salvation. We are all connected, he says, and responsible for each other. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Bethlehem.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is Friday, and later this hour we'll bring you Wisconsin Life. Today we'll hear about a holiday tradition in the state that folks use to warm up in cold weather, a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry. That's in 25 minutes.
When you support WPR through your IRA or with gifts of stock, you're giving the gift of award-winning reporting and essential information to tens of thousands of people in your community and around the state. Share the public radio you love and keep it going strong for years to come with your gift of stock or IRA giving. Call your financial advisor or visit WPR.org/support to learn more.
Support for WPR comes from the Century House, featuring Herman Miller furniture and stressless Norwegian recliners on University Avenue in Madison, furnishing homes and offices since 1948. CenturyHouseInc.com.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, premiering a YouTube video review of past Christmas concerts December 29th at 7 p.m., followed by a video conference afterglow. In conjunction, the Sebastians is offering a special curbside pickup dinner. Visit choralartsonline.org.
Looks like on this Christmas day, partly sunny in the Northeast, mostly sunny for the rest of the state. We'll have highs in the upper teens with wind chills of 5 to 15 below zero possible. On Saturday, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the 20s.
NPR comes from this station and from AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected more than 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning. From Amazon Studios with the new film Sylvie's Love, a romance between an aspiring TV producer and a saxophonist in 1950s Harlem, starring Tessa Thompson and Namdi Asomugha. Now streaming on Prime Video. And from ServPro, with ServPro Emergency Ready Profiles to minimize business interruption after a disaster. At 1-800-SERVPRO or servpro.com/NPR. ServPro, like it never even happened.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. The Chicago Police Department is trying to rebuild trust in communities with which it has a terrible relationship. So it launched an outreach program that's designed to change the ways in which police approach their work. Here's NPR's Cheryl Corley.
At a recent food giveaway at a Chicago park, a cluster of police officers wearing masks greeted drivers and loaded boxes of food in the trunks of a long line of cars.
How many?
I have court. I got to get online for court.
25th District Police Commander Arnaldo Gutierrez watched to make sure things were going smoothly.
We're here to work together with the community. We want the community to embrace us, embrace each other. It's making sure that there's no violence in our district, in our neighborhoods. That means we got to work together as a team.
This is a collaboration with an area church and an alderman's office, and it's here in the 25th District where Chicago decided to go a step further. The district is the first to set up a neighborhood policing initiative patterned after a similar program in New York City.
The best way to reduce crime is to prevent it from happening in the first place.
That's Chicago Police Superintendent David Brown.
And you do that through community policing. Getting officers out of the cars and into the barbershops and beauty salon and churches and into the living rooms of our neighborhoods where they are assigned is community policing.
The notion of community policing isn't new, but it takes on a bigger meaning now after this summer's protest. Instead of working from one radio assignment to the next, district coordinating officers, or DCOs as they are called, hand out business cards and encourage people to email or call them on their cell phone. They work together with residents to resolve problematic non-emergencies like speeding cars or a loud neighbor. The officers have helped some residents find jobs, the homeless places to live, and they often turn to beat officers, businesses, and community groups for assistance. Commander Angel Navalis, the head of the Office of Community Policing, says he's witnessed something among the DCOs you don't hear much about these days.
Joy that comes from helping members of the community. That's why we came on the job. We weren't just showing up and writing reports and making an arrest and moving on to the next thing.
Instead, says Navalis, they are actually creating strategies with people to solve problems. Officer Malcolm Brooks says he wanted to help change the perception of the police, and after a couple of years on the job, he signed up to be a district coordinating officer. Brooks says they get calls day and night.
We deal with people who have mental health issues. We deal with people who may be out of work, because we've helped people get jobs. We helped a lady find an apartment.
And work to build relationships, he says, with business owners and residents. City officials say in the 25th Police District, where it all started nearly 2 years ago, there have been 10,000 fewer calls this year to the 911 emergency number, a drop city officials directly credit to people having direct contact with officers who were part of the Neighborhood Initiative, a program that's now active in 5 police districts challenged by crime and gangs. The 25th Police District is big, also diverse, but its nearly 200,000 people live in distinct neighborhoods, largely defined by ethnicity, on the west and northwest sides of Chicago.
Good morning. Good morning. How are you?
Okay. Just go up the stairs and to your right.
Ronald Wilkes, a retired pastor, lives in a brick two-flat on a tree-lined street about a block behind the police station. He's the president of the Streets Block Club and a community ambassador, a point of contact for the police in their outreach and for residents. He says there has been tension between police and residents here for decades, but the ambassadors know the area and the community and work with the officers explaining what's going on in the neighborhoods, the hot spots, when crime is happening. He says the DCOs have made a difference in certain areas, but not all of the district.
Now, could this plan work? Yeah. It could, because when we first jumped off, we was all over the place. They was walking the streets with us, getting introduced to people and things. But something happened.
What happened in the 25th, says Bertha Purnell, was a lack of follow-through by new officers. She's another community ambassador and a longtime resident.
I feel like we're not taken seriously a lot of the times because it's almost like pulling teeth. To get information.
Purnell says too many DCOs get pulled off the job to handle other police duties. Police commanders cycle in and out of the job, too. That means they have to try building new relationships over and over again. Commander Novalis says attrition, reflective of cops leaving the profession nationwide and officers being promoted, have affected the program. But he expects that may be resolved as the initiative grows.
The question is, what are the key elements that will get translated as it expands?
Northwestern University professor Andrew Papakristos, who's been evaluating the program, says there's been frustration on both sides, but overall, results in the 25th district, at least before the summer protests, seemed promising. He says both residents and officers felt like relationships were moving in a better direction. But there's a caveat. Papakristos says no one should expect the DCOs and the Neighborhood Policing Initiative will cause any drop in crime.
The mistrust and the cynicism in the police took centuries to get to where it is. And so if crime is going to improve because of that trust, it's going to lag behind. It's going to take years to build and work on this relationship, especially as we as a society reckon with the history of policing in America.
City officials agree, saying the policing initiative won't be able to resolve all the long-standing issues rooted in a lack of trust and respect, like police misconduct or stop-and-frisk policies that have caused a rift between police and communities. Still, Chicago's mayor, the police superintendent, and many residents call the program with the district coordinating officers a positive police reform. They say eventually it should be a citywide project to bring police and residents together to solve problems, to work for safe streets and safe homes, and to build trust, block by block. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, the Federal Election Commission hasn't been operating for months because there are not enough commissioners. Now it has a backlog of 400 cases of potential campaign finance violations. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or just ask for your member station by name.
This is NPR News.
To keep the holiday spirit alive during a difficult year, some of our listeners put a spin on their beloved Christmas traditions.
I have a Puerto Rican Christmas music playlist, and these past few weeks, we've been singing our favorite songs and just transporting ourselves to a bajaranda in Puerto Rico.
I'm Ari Shapiro, rethinking holiday celebrations this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In news, operating while intoxicated, convictions and crashes in Wisconsin have declined in recent years, according to a new report. A look at some possible reasons for that coming up in our newscast after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Barbara Klein. California is the first state to confirm more than 2 million coronavirus cases. Nurse Cammy Witt says getting tested and wishes aren't enough to affect the infection rate this holiday.
It's one thing to say you want this to end. It's another to do something to end this.
She says slowing the spread requires masking and social distancing. Pope Francis used his Christmas Day message to appeal for international cooperation in sharing coronavirus vaccines, NPR's Silvio Poggioli reports.
In his message to the city and the world, Pope Francis said, in this time of environmental crisis and serious economic and social imbalances worsened by the pandemic, it's important to acknowledge one another as brothers and sisters. In this moment of darkness, he added, the discovery of vaccines is a ray of hope.
Non possiamo lasciare che I nazionalismi chiusi.
We cannot allow nationalistic narrow-mindedness and the virus of radical individualism make us indifferent to the suffering of others, he said. Francis called for a spirit of international cooperation in healthcare because in the face of a challenge that knows no borders, we cannot erect walls, the Pope said. All of us are in the same boat. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
This is NPR.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Wisconsin health officials are reporting nearly 2,800 new COVID-19 cases in the state. Yesterday, the State Department of Health Services reported 2,799 newly confirmed cases. There were 60 new deaths from COVID-19. The overall death toll is now 4,674. Of the people who got tested for COVID-19 over the past week, 25.1% were positive for the disease, according to DHS. That rate has fallen steadily from 27.9% on December 16th to 25.1% on Wednesday. The DHS hadn't posted the rate as of Thursday. Alcohol-related fatal crashes have declined in Wisconsin over the past 12 years. That's according to a recent report from the Legislative Reference Bureau. The report says while policy changes like new sanctions and prevention measures have contributed to the decline, there's no single cause. Paul Moberg of UW-Madison's Population Health Institute says one factor is personal responsibility.
People are more aware that impaired driving is a danger, and I think it's less socially sanctioned at this point. It's sort of like the old three martini lunch. We don't hear much about that anymore either.
Despite the improvements, the report says operating while intoxicated remains a serious challenge that can cost Wisconsinites hundreds of millions of dollars per year. Former University of Wisconsin System President Ray Cross never delivered written reports on how to increase campus diversity and improve the presidential search process, even though he signed a $125,000 contract requiring him to produce them. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Cross signed the three-consulting contract after he resigned as president on June 30th. The newspaper filed an open records request for the reports in early October, but university officials said no records existed because Cross delivered verbal recommendations. System officials declined to provide any details on what Cross said, calling them private conversations. Regents President Andrew Peterson said the system created a diversity scholarship based on Cross's recommendations. WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Partly sunny in the Northeast today, mostly sunny for the rest of the state, highs in the upper teens.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from C3, C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from AT&T, committed to keeping students and teachers connected. AT&T has connected more than 200 million students with tools and technology for distance learning. More at att.com/remote learning.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green in Los Angeles.
And I'm Noel King in Washington, D.C. Good morning. It took Congress 7 months to pass a COVID relief bill. It seemed like a done deal. It wasn't. President Trump had problems with the bill. The biggest was he wanted people to get larger direct payments, $2,000 instead of $600, which is also what Democrats originally wanted. So yesterday, they tried again to get it. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is with us to talk about what happened next. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So the president is currently at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Has he said anything about the relief bill?
No, he has not. As of last night, I was told the bill, as in the paper copy of the bill, was in the process of being delivered to the president in Florida. This person who was familiar with the process did not indicate how it was getting there, though I would like to imagine that Santa is just stashing all 5,000 pages under a tree in Mar-a-Lago. The president himself claims to be working tirelessly for the American people. His schedule says that he has many meetings and calls, though it doesn't outline what they are. He's been tweeting up a storm, and we have seen pictures of him golfing. In the tweets, he is talking about a lot of things, but not this COVID bill, including really going after Republicans, saying that, you know, everyone he had been talking to said that they should be up in arms fighting for him and that they aren't. He complained that, you know, he helped them win re-election and they aren't helping him now.
What is the Republican reaction to his demand for these $2,000 payments, which Democrats have seized on? Like, yeah, we'd love it.
Yeah, they're like, thank you very much. Let's do this. Republicans say not so fast. You know, Democrats in the House brought up legislation yesterday through what is known as unanimous consent to try to pass these $2,000 direct payments that the president wanted. But with unanimous consent, everyone has to agree to it. And if one person objects, one member of Congress objects, then it doesn't pass. Republican did object, therefore it didn't happen. House Democrats say they'll try again on Monday. But even if that bill passes in the House, Republican leadership in the Senate are saying there's no way that could get 60 votes. There's no way it could pass.
So messy. Are Republicans, who typically are pretty timid when it comes to the president and his anger, are they expressing any frustration or are they just being quiet?
They are being more expressive than usual. I will say that we haven't heard from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who President Trump has been tweeting about, not since McConnell tweeted a celebratory note 3 days ago saying that help was on the way immediately. Republican lawmakers have been expressing a combination of confusion, dismay, frustration, complaining that the president's team was involved in these negotiations and knew exactly what was happening with this legislation. Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri is a member of the GOP leadership. He told reporters yesterday he had no idea what the president would ultimately do, whether he would sign or veto, but he thinks the president should sign it.
If you start opening part of the bill up, it's hard to defend not opening the whole bill up. It took us a long time to get to where we are. I think reopening that bill would be a mistake.
And he says that the president's unpredictability here is a distraction from what could be positive news about the COVID-19 vaccine process. And instead, everybody's talking about this.
I mean, at the end of the day, this remains about the fact that millions of Americans are still struggling. So what does happen next?
Right. And this is also attached to a government funding bill to keep the government funded and open through the end of September. So if the president doesn't sign this by Monday night, there could be a government shutdown in addition to all these benefits not coming through for people.
NPR's Tamara Keith. Merry, messy Christmas, Tam.
Indeed. You too.
All right, so in a year when the distribution of vaccines is so important, the International Police Organization has a serious warning, also known as Interpol. They're cautioning people about the dangers of counterfeit vaccines. Stacey Vanek-Smith and Cardiff Garcia from our daily economics podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money, wanted to find out more about this, and so they took a trip into the dark web.
The COVID crisis has created a whole universe of opportunity for criminals. Fear and scarcity and high demand are very powerful market forces.
Chad Anderson has been watching these forces play out for months. He's a senior security researcher at Domain Tools.
We're a cyber threat intelligence data company, so we scan the entire internet as many times as we can every single day and give insights to customers based upon what we see.
And part of the whole internet is the so-called dark web. That's the unregulated part of the web where a lot of illegal activity happens.
Like, what is the dark web like?
There's many things when people talk about the dark web, but most of the time what people are referring to is these anonymous services and illegal forums or illegal marketplaces.
Illegal marketplaces where you can buy drugs or weapons or passports or COVID vaccines.
So now we're starting to see some coronavirus vaccines. You know, I'm looking at maybe 200 different ads here.
So can you read us some of the ads that you've found?
Yeah, let me pull one up I'm looking at here. So, you know, the ad says 10 COVID-19 vaccines. The price is 3,276 euros.
That's about 4,000 US dollars. So about $400 per vaccine.
Yeah, and for the record, Chad does not think that these vaccines are legit. For one thing, the Pfizer vaccine requires a very intense cold storage chain. The vaccines have to be kept at negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And also, the COVID vaccine ads are mixed in with ads for all kinds of other things. And Chad says that tends to be a red flag.
Since we're in the seas, you scroll up and there's cocaine. You know, scroll down, you've got your heroin and, you know, Molly, meth, you name it, as well as, you know, this site has firearms.
Chad says the global COVID crisis has been a massive opportunity for cyber criminals. He says the online marketplaces are still a tiny part of it right now, and most of the criminal activity has involved ransomware.
Chad says because lives are at stake and there's so much chaos and urgency right now, criminal organizations know that if they hack into the system of a hospital, they can demand and probably get a lot of money. Back in October, one hospital in New Jersey paid cyber criminals more than $650,000 after the criminals locked up their computer systems and threatened to publish all of their patient records.
Chad expects that these kinds of attacks will become more frequent in coming months. Because after all, the payoff for those kinds of attacks are much bigger than a couple of thousand dollars for the COVID vaccines.
Although, Chad also expects the vaccine marketplace will continue to grow on the dark web. Stacey Vanek Smith,
Cardiff Garcia, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Merrill. Merrill Guided Investing helps manage a client's portfolio. MerrillEdge.com/investing goals. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, both a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Pixar's new animated film Soul begins streaming today on Disney Plus. It's the story of Joe Gardner, voiced by actor Jamie Foxx, a middle school music teacher who dreams of performing jazz on stage. Ahead, we'll hear from John Batiste, who contributed music to the movie. That's in 9 minutes.
Classical music in concert is always a pleasure, even more so when the music is not only live, but local. Enjoy recorded performances of Wisconsin classical musicians, Sunday at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of brands like Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex. More about Kimberly-Clark's 148 years of commitment to innovation at kimberly-clark.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program provides free income tax preparation assistance and e-filing for low to moderate income households. Volunteers are needed. Call 262-658-4104.
Coming up at 9 this morning, Stephanie Elkins is your host for festive holiday music here on WPR. The first hour includes a choral melody and the Nutcracker Suite. After that, carols on the hammered dulcimer, arranged for brass, and lots of singing. Also, Jingle Bells, Sleigh Ride, White Christmas, a few roasting chestnuts, and some seasonal spirituals. That's all coming up starting at 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Partly sunny in the northeast today, mostly sunny for the rest of the state. We'll have highs in the upper teens with wind chills of 5 to 15 below zero possible. On Saturday, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the 20s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Merrill. Merrill Edge Self-Directed Investing has tools to help clients find answers to questions. More at merrilledge.com/withinreach. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil Fiber Gummies. Made with a blend of prebiotic plant-based fibers that provide 5 grams of fiber in each serving. Designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com.
It's 8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry. By the way, this was recorded last year before the pandemic.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering,
is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Scotty favorite brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas, who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
Lovely.
If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, You can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What do you have, lad?
Oh, whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Racine Theater Guild is hosting their Home for the Holidays concert, live streaming online December 18th at 7:30. The concert will also be available on demand through December 31st. Visit racinetheater.org/maps.
It'll be partly sunny in the northeast today, mostly sunny for the rest of Wisconsin. Highs in the upper teens, wind chills of 5 to 15 below zero are possible.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Pixar's new animated film, Soul, begins streaming today on Disney+. It's the story of Joe Gardner, voiced by actor Jamie Foxx. He's a middle school music teacher who dreams of performing jazz on stage.
Music is all I think about. From the moment I wake up in the morning to the moment I fall asleep at night. I was born to play.
Much of the music in the film is by the very real-life jazz musician John Batiste. As NPR's Mondalit Del Barco reports, he was also an inspiration for the animators.
Ooh, hello.
I reached John Batiste at his home outside New York City, where, as always, he was listening to music. He talked about Joe Gardner, the animated star of Soul.
I love Joe because he has this vision for his life and this thing that makes him feel alive.
Like Joe, Batiste was born to play the piano. In fact, Born to Play is the name of one of the songs he wrote for Soul. Batiste not only put his own soul into creating the movie's music, but also those are his fingers playing the piano as Joe Gardner.
Oh my goodness, my way of playing, my hands, they're exact replica in the 3D kind of animation, the way that he kind of moves his body. You'll see, if you watch the film and then see me playing, it's kind of crazy. I was almost in tears because you see your essence and you think, wow, this is the first Black Pixar lead. And we're putting jazz culture out there in this massive way in the essence of this main character.
It also helps that John has these long, lanky fingers that really lend themselves to like a dynamic look when it's fully animated.
Playwright Kemp Powers co-directed and co-wrote Soul. He says Batiste was a jazz ambassador for the film.
One of the first things he said to us was that he sees jazz as literally the newest form of music there is because you're literally making it up in the moment.
Powers says Batiste pulled together the session musicians for a scene in the jazz club. And Powers says the film included a lot of Batiste's ideas about jazz.
When Joe is speaking to his class and he tells a story about the first time he ever heard like a jazz musician play, that's almost verbatim a story that John told us.
I see this guy and he's playing his chords with force on it. And then with a minor, then he has the inner voices and it's like he's singing. And I swear the next thing I know, it's like he flips. floats off the stage. That guy was lost in the music. He was in it, and he took the rest of us with him.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's called getting in the zone. It's just transcendent. It's almost as if everything that's happening is aligned with the greater force that is controlling the universe, and God is just pulling the puppet strings, and the audience is just in tune, and everybody is in the same space on the same frequency. That's why we play. And I think there's something about that that is the closest to utopia that we'll get to.
Batiste's been in the zone since before he was born. He comes from a long line of New Orleans musicians, including his father, Michael, a bassist who performed with Jackie Wilson and Isaac Hayes in the 60s and 70s. His dad also co-founded the Batiste Brothers Band.
Seven brothers. That was a family band. They played R&B, soul, funk, New Orleans music. But then my first mentor in jazz was the great Alvin Batiste, the late clarinetist who taught everyone from New Orleans music over the last 40 years. And then Lionel Batiste and Milton Batiste, the Olympia Brass Band, which is like second line marching band music. And, you know, my cousin Russell Batiste, who played with the Funky Meters. Wow. I mean, there are at least 30 of the Batiste relatives that are cousins of mine, my uncles, second cousins. It's a rich family tradition, I'll say.
Batiste actually grew up just outside New Orleans in Kenner, Louisiana. As a youngster, he played drums with the family band. At 11, he began playing the piano, and by 13, he was playing professionally with his friend Troy Andrews, trombone shorty. After high school, Batiste studied music at Juilliard. Shortly after he graduated, he performed on the Colbert Report. Then Stephen Colbert asked him to be the house band for The Late Show.
John!
Hello, what's happening?
Besides leading his band Stay Human on the show, the 34-year-old Batiste is also featured in comical video segments. The chemistry and admiration between Colbert and Batiste is on frequent display.
I'm proud to work with you.
Oh, man, likewise.
That's a clip from the show in June, just after Batiste led a peaceful and musical Black Lives Matter march through the streets of New York City. Thousands of people followed him like a Pied Piper to protest police brutality.
People reached out to me saying that really just gave me hope to kind of go through the next few months, because seeing you out there and using your voice and your music to really give voice to all the things that we're feeling, we needed somebody to be out there doing that.
Batiste continues themes of Black empowerment in his new album, We Are, which comes out in March. The first single features his voice, those of his young nephews, and all 100 musicians of the Marching 100 from his alma mater, St. Augustine High School. Also, the New Orleans Gospel Soul Children's Choir and his grandfather, an elder at the Union Bethel AME Church.
My grandfather, David Gaucher, is preaching on the record. He was the president of the Louisiana Postal Workers Union and led protests and organized around the sanitation strike with Martin Luther King Jr. There's just so much in the track that I felt like even if people don't know the backstory, they're going to feel the vibrations in it.
Batiste has a lot more projects up his sleeve. He's up for 2 Grammys, and right now he's proud to present Soul, the film he says has many lessons about finding your spark.
You know, purpose isn't about being famous or having money or being this celebrated person. It's found in the things that make us all unique, and there's never gonna be another person like you in the world, ever. You're the only one, you're one of a kind, and that's beautiful.
That's John Batiste, who, spoiler alert, can also be heard singing during the end credits of Soul. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News. 'Cause you've
got soul. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. You've got soul, and everybody knows
that it's all right. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Special thanks to John Davis, who keeps the news flowing in the morning. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. And to follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. Classical music for the holiday with Stephanie Elkins is on the way.
Support for WPR comes from EdVest, Wisconsin's 529 college savings plan for families with higher education goals. More at edvest.com. TIAA CREF Tuition Financing, Inc. Plan Manager.
Support comes from the Choral Arts Society, premiering a YouTube video review of past Christmas concerts December 29th at 7 p.m., followed by a video conference afterglow. In conjunction, the Sebastians is offering a special curbside pickup dinner. Visit choralartsonline.org. You're listening to WGTD HD.